Under the Olive Tree, the Palestinian Canadian Community Radio Show. You are listening to CKUT, Radio McGill 90.3 FM in Montreal. And I'm your host for the week, Laith Maarouf. Today is December 22nd, 2005, and the hour is 11. We will be with you till noon, as usual. Under the Olive Tree is more than just a radio show. We have two reasons for our existence. The first is to provide the space, the knowledge, and the equipment for Palestinian youth in order for them to learn the skills of radio. That leads us to the second purpose, which is to produce content that truly represents the Palestinian community. If you have any questions or you'd like to join our production team, you can contact us at our email, uot@ckut.ca. Again, that's uot@ckut.ca. Those are our initials under the Olive Tree, UOT. Or you can call us at our number, area code 514-398-6788, and leave us a message. Again, that number is area code 514-398-6788. Today's show is our Christmas and Hanukkah special, where we will be checking on the Christian and Jewish Palestinian members of our community to find out about their situation, celebrating and commemorating, and some may say, a mourning. We have two interviews. The first one is conducted by Hanin Amr, and the interview is with Father Robert Asali, who is the director of the Canadian chapter of Friends of Sabil, the ecumenical rights group in Palestine. And the second interview is with Yuri Davis, a professor who calls himself a Palestinian Hebrew. You will listen to his interpretation of this title. The interview is conducted by Linda Tabar. Before we start with the interviews, I would like to put on one song. It is by Fayrouz, conducted by the Rehbani brothers, Zahrat al-Mada'in, the Flower of Cities. And it's a song that is dedicated definitely to Jerusalem, because that is one of the many titles that are given to Jerusalem, Al-Quds, by the original inhabitants of Palestine. Here's the song.
تدور في أروقة المعاني ليلة الإسراء يا درب من مروا إلى السماء عيوننا إليك ترحل كل يوم وإنني الطفل في المغارة وأمه مريم وجهان يبكيان
الطفل في المغارة وأمه مريم وجهان يبكيان
يبكيان لأجل من تشردوا لأجل أطفال بلا منازل لأجل من دافع واستشهد في المداخل واستشهد السلام في وطن السلام وسقط العدل على المداخل
سقط العدل سقط العدل سقط العدل على المداخل
حين هوت مدينة القدس تراجع الحب وفي قلوب الدنيا استوطنت الحرب حين هوت مدينة القدس تراجع الحب وفي قلوب الدنيا استوطنت الحرب الطفل في المغارة
من كل طريق بجياد الرهبة وكوجه الله الغامر
لن يقفل باب مدينتنا فأنا ذاهبة لأصلي سأدق على الأبواب وسأفتحها الأبواب وستغسل يا نهر الأردن وجهي بمياه قدسية وستمحو يا نهر الأردن أثار القدم الهمجية الغضب الساطع بجياد الرهبة الغضب الساطع بجياد الرهبة وسيهزم وجه القوة سيهزم وجه القوة البيت لنا والقدس لنا وبأيدينا سنعيد بهاء القدس بأيدينا للقدس سلام
بأيدينا للقدس سلام
بأيدينا للقدس سلام
بأيدينا للقدس سلام
was Fayrouz singing Zahrat al-Madain, The Flower of Cities. A great song, one song that we, a lot of us Palestinians, have grew up on. Our first interview of the day is with Father Robert Asali, president or director of the Canadian Friends of Sabil. The interview is conducted by Haneen Amr. It's part of our show that is dedicated to Christmas and Hanukkah in our community. We listen to the interview.
I'm talking with Father Robert Asali. He is chairman of the Canadian Friends of Sabil. He is joining us today from Ottawa to talk to us about the organization and its main goals. Father Asali, how are you today?
I'm doing wonderfully, Haneen. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for joining us on Under the Olive Tree on CQT Montreal. So to begin, Father Asali, you're a member of the organization named Sabil. Can you describe to our listeners what is Sabil and what are the major goals of this organization?
I'm chair of Canadian Friends of Sabil, and Sabil is a Jerusalem-based organization of all Christian denominations that is seeking to articulate a theology that can explain the situation that Palestinian Christians find themselves in, and to help them find a way out. And part of that, of course, is that the Palestinian Christians are very much a part of the whole Palestinian community, and therefore they're articulating ways of resolving the situation there to the benefit of all Palestinians, and to ensure that international law particularly is enforced and that justice is achieved. And justice is really a focus of Sabil.
Can you describe to us a little bit of what is the situation of the Christian Palestinians living in Bethlehem, for example?
Well, the situation of Christian Palestinians in general is that their numbers have dwindled substantially from the numbers in 1948, and only 2% of Christians now in the occupied, 2% of Palestinians in the occupied territories are Christian. And they have all kinds of additional difficulties, aside from the difficulties that all Palestinians face. They have additional difficulties of being a minority there, and of being having difficult access to churches in Bethlehem, for instance, on Christmas Eve. Most Christians will not be able to go to church, and the Israeli authorities are continuing the clampdown and the occupation, and it makes it very, very difficult for Christians to operate, and of course for Christians to continue, for Palestinians to continue to stay in Palestine. It's important that the economy be strong, that there be jobs, that there be future for the young people, and so on. And unfortunately, that's simply not the case now. And the Christians, more likely than the Muslims, are inclined to emigrate to greener pastures.
And about the access to Jerusalem for Christian Palestinians that are going to their pilgrimage, can you tell us about a little bit about that, the situation of that access?
Well, the access is really quite dreadful. I'll tell you my own personal experience of it. This is a decade ago now, and it's even worse than that. We got on a bus in Jerusalem to go to Bethlehem with on Christmas Eve, and much to my surprise, there were no Palestinians allowed on the bus. All the foreigners were frisked by the Israeli military. And the only exception was the Palestinian bishop of Jerusalem. He was allowed to go down. And we got there. Bethlehem was completely under curfew. And we drove into this surreal scene of quiet, because everybody was locked down in their homes. And we tried to worship, but it was very difficult to worship in the Church of the Nativity. It was difficult because we knew the reality into which Christ was born in Bethlehem is uglier today than it was even 2,000 years ago.
And as you know, today North Americans are preparing for their holidays right about now, and surely for the coming days. In Palestine, the Christian Palestinians, acknowledging the hardship of the occupation and the construction of the apartheid wall, the so-called security fence, how do they deal? Like, how do they celebrate? How do they like, how do they manage to prepare for these holidays and to celebrate Christmas?
Well, this year is going to be a new situation because the Christian areas are in, not entirely, in Bethlehem, Beit Zehur, Beit Shala, just south of Jerusalem, and this year the wall has sliced those areas, and more than sliced them in two. It sliced them in several directions, and families can't even get together now to visit within the same town, within Bethlehem. They can't get together to visit. They can't go to church. Family life has been virtually decimated for many families. One of the convents can't even is cut off by the wall from the Church of the Nativity. It's absolute madness, and how it's going to play out this year, I don't know. But there's, as we've been seeing in the news this week, there's obviously a lot of anxiety and upset about it.
Do you have any last words you would like to add to our listeners?
Well, I think it's very important to remember at two levels that there. That it's not just about what we read on the news. I mean, we hear about the apartheid wall, mm-hmm. But it goes much further than that. The way that the wall destroys people's daily life can be seen at its worst at times like this at Christmas, and at another level, it affects all Palestinians. And the Christian community needs tremendous support because it adds a wealth and a richness to all of Palestinian society. And there's a great risk that the Christian community, which is 2,000 years old in Palestine, is going to disappear.
So for our listeners, if you would like to know a little bit more about Sabil organization, you could log on to www.sabil.ca. That's S-A-B-W-E-L. Father Asali, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Under the Olive Tree. I wish you all the best for the holidays and the new coming year. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Hanin, and my personal greetings to all your listeners.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Ooh.
شوارع الإنس العتيقة خلي الغنية تصير عواصف وهديل يا صوتي ضلك طاير زوبع بهالضماير خبر هون عاللي صاير بلك بيوع الضمير يا صوتي ضلك طاير زوبع بهالضماير خبر هون عاللي صاير بلك بيوع الضمير خبر هون عاللي صاير بلك بيوع
That was Father Robert Asali, the director of the Canadian chapter of Friends of Sabil, speaking on the situation of Christian Palestinians in Bethlehem and other parts of Palestine under occupation. He was being interviewed by Hanin Amr. The interview was followed by a song again by Fayrouz, and it is called Al-Quds Al-Atiqa, which means Old Jerusalem. It is, of course, without doubt, dedicated to Jerusalem. Our next interview is with Professor Yuri Davis. He teaches in two universities in the United Kingdom and had taught in Israel in many universities there too. He was born in Palestine pre the creation of the Zionist state in 1948, and he calls himself a Palestinian Hebrew. We listen to the interview conducted by Linda Tabar.
Welcome to Under the Olive Tree, and thank you for joining us today, Dr. Davis.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to be interviewed.
Can you please explain to our listeners what you mean when you identify yourself as a Palestinian Jew?
There is a problem with definition of identities in situations such as Israel and Palestine. The core of the conflict is a conflict between a settler colonial state and an indigenous people. And the difficulty is to separate between one's identity as defined in humanitarian terms and one's identity as defined by the settler colonial legal instruments. Under Israeli law, as Jewish, not by religion, but by nationality. In Israeli law, there is no recognition of Israeli nationality. There's recognition of Israeli citizenship, but all attempts by individuals or groups of people to register their nationality as Israeli were rejected by the courts. Israel is defined in law as a Jewish and a democratic state. Judaism is viewed in hybrid terms as both religion and nationality. There is no separation between religion and nationality in Israeli law. And the privileges are allocated by the settler colonial state to all persons registered in law as Jewish and denied from all those who are not so registered, and in the first instance to the indigenous peoples of the country of Palestine, the Palestinian Arab people. As in Palestine, as in South Africa and Indonesia or Algeria, settler colonial states survive by perpetrating war crimes and crimes against humanity. In the case of Palestine, it was the perpetration of the crime of ethnic cleansing, and that crime has been perpetrated in the name of the security of the settler colonial state, the security of the Jewish people worldwide and the Jewish citizens of the State of Israel, and in the name of all citizens of the State of Israel, and all Jewish people worldwide. So those of us who broke away from the value system that informs the conduct of the settler colonial state of Israel find themselves in quandary, an attempt at the political level and at the level of identity of defining independent narratives and separate narratives from the narratives imposed by the predominant and prevailing legal system. And there have been a number of attempts in various directions to effect that. I found the most productive instrument is to decouple from the idea of the state. And I was assisted in doing that by the fact that, in fact, I am privileged to two citizenships. I'm privileged to Israeli citizenship, being born in Jerusalem and being born to a Jewish family and therefore entitled to Israeli citizenship by the Israeli law of return, and to UK citizenship, my father being of British extraction, arriving in Jerusalem in the mid-30s, I inherited British citizenship as well. And I also worked in the United Kingdom for the better part of two decades. So I'll begin with the United Kingdom rather than with Israel or with Britain rather than Palestine. There is a distinction between the name of the state and the name of the country. The name of the country is Britain. The name of the state is not Britain. The name of the state, the official name of the state, is United Kingdom. And therefore, it is possible to construct a narrative that says, well, the country is Britain. There are at least four separate nationalities resident in Britain, English, Welsh, Scottish and Irish. There are now many more. There are Pakistani nationals and Indian nationals and Sikh nationals and such like. But for sake of simplicity, let's confine ourselves to the mention of four nationalities. And they are citizens in a state called the United Kingdom. The citizenship is uniform, regardless of national identity. Under English law, at least in theory, all citizens have equal standing in the courts of law. So you have a conceptual separation between nationality, citizenship, and country. If one tries to introduce this distinction into the Israeli-Palestinian colonial situation, then the name of the country would be Palestine, the name of the state would be Israel, and it still remains the case, the problem still remains of how one would define one's nationality. The state does not recognize Israeli nationality, and anyway, under Israeli citizenship law, there are at least four classes of citizenship, first class, second class, third class and fourth class, and I can elaborate on that. So saying that one is an Israeli national, apartheid segregation between various classes of citizenship, being an Israeli and being registered as a Jew is not the same as being an Israeli and being registered as an Arab, for instance. The registration as Jewish implies in law privileges denied to those registered as an Arab. So and identifying one's national identity in Israeli skirts over the reality of 20% of people who have Israeli citizenship are actually not Jews. So Israeli is not overlapping or coextensive with being Jewish. And anyway, Judaism is best left as a confessional definition rather than as a national definition. There is a quandary there. So some people solve the dilemma by saying, well, we would define our national identity as Israeli Jews, which goes covers some part of the distance or solves a good proportion of the dilemma, but not for me, primarily because I'm committed to the liberal principle of separation of religion from the state. And the state is Israel, and for me, Judaism designates religion. And if I'm for the separation of religion from the state, the conjunction Israeli Jew does exactly the opposite. It weds a state to religion. Then people would say, well, Judaism is a national designation, so Israeli Jew is a national identity. But then if it is a national identity, it doesn't have a critical edge, because I would like my national identity as a citizen of Israel to reflect the fact that Israeli Jewish national identity is an apartheid national identity, that by virtue of one's being designated as an Israeli Jew, one is privileged in law in a way that is not acceptable, and people who are designated as Israeli Arabs, for instance, or would be designated as Israeli Arabs, are not equal citizens to Israeli Jews. So all of that rather complex and disjointed introduction is an attempt to identify a critical element and to identify a terminology that would reflect that critical element and would reflect the problematics, and I'm not sure that I outlined the problematics as coherently as I would want to. The solution that I came up with is, again, to assist the definition with the distinction between the country and state. So if the country is Palestine and I was born in Jerusalem, I would be a Palestinian by virtue of birth, not by ethnic definition of European extraction, but by virtue of birth, I would be a Palestinian. It helps because there is a common assumption that Palestinian identity is coextensive with Arab identity, and we all know that that cannot be the case, that there are entire important constituencies of Palestinian nationals, Palestinian people, Palestinian with national identity, who are not ethnically Arab Palestinians. There are Palestinian Armenians, for instance. There are Palestinians who are offsprings of an ethnic Palestinian spouse and a European spouse, who are both Palestinians and Europeans. It's a hybrid identity and should be recognized as a hybrid identity. And one could be both Arab and Palestinian and non-Arab and Palestinian and European and Palestinian. If one divorces the one's Palestinian identity from ethnic identity. And in Palestine, if one takes the mainstream confessional divisions, the three monotheistic divisions, then there are Palestinian Muslims and Palestinian Jews and Palestinian Christians. So there is a critical element in the conjunction of Palestinian Jew, which I find very helpful in defining my politics and my political narrative. I also must admit that when I coined the term for myself, Palestinian Jew, which was about a decade ago, I coined the term Palestinian Jew, a citizen of the State of Israel and a Palestinian Jewish national, about 10 years ago. And I changed tack a little bit. Again, largely because of the dissatisfaction of joining a religious designation to a political designation. And if you want to know what is my preferred label today, 10 years after coining the designation Palestinian Jew, I'll tell you, it's a Palestinian Hebrew. So if you want the full the full label, it would go something like that. I am a Palestinian Hebrew by national designation. I'm Jewish by confessional designation. I'm a dual citizen of the State of Israel and the United Kingdom. And I'm politically committed to an anti-Zionist political program. I believe the idea of a Jewish state as interpreted in the mainstream of Zionism, political Zionism, is not a good idea, it's a destructive idea, and should be reformed in a way that is similar to the reforms that we had been fortunate to witness with the transformation of South Africa from an apartheid state to a state governed by a democratic constitution. And I hope all of this makes sense to you.
أنا أحمد العربي قال أنا الرصاص البرتقال الذكريات وجدت نفسي قرب نفسي فابتعدت عن الندى والمشهد البحري وأنا البلاد وقد أتت وتقمصتني وأنا الذهاب المستمر إلى البلاد وجدت نفسي ملء نفسي راح أحمد يلتقي بضلوعه ويديه كان الخطوة النجمة ومن المحيط إلى الخليج من الخليج إلى المحيط كانوا يعدون الرماح وأحمد العربي يصعد كي يرى حيفا ويقفز أحمد الآن الرهينة تركت شوارعها المدينة وأتت إليه لتقتله ومن الخليج إلى المحيط من المحيط إلى الخليج كانوا يعدون الجنازة وانتخاب المقصلة.
That was Marcel Khalifa reading a poem for Palestine's greatest poet, Mahmoud Darwish, and the poem is called Ahmed al-Arabi, Ahmed the Arab. It is from a collection by the same title, an album called Ahmed al-Arab that is also a collection for Mahmoud Darwish's poetry. We will go back to the interview with Professor Yuri Davis, a Palestinian Hebrew. We go back to the interview for that explanation on what is a Palestinian Hebrew, and the interview is conducted by Linda Tabar.
I'd just like to ask you at this point if you could maybe go into the history somewhat, building on this designation of Palestinian Hebrew. Tell us briefly about the original Palestinian Hebrew community in Palestine, which predated Zionist settlement. What happened to this community?
I'm happy to do so, but before doing that, I'd like to take the opportunity to elaborate on an advantage, because coining the term Palestinian Hebrew allows me to consider a future on the basis of reciprocity and equality of rights. And in a way allows me to skirt around or integrate or transcend the division between a one-state solution or and a two-state solution in a manner that could be interesting not only speculatively but also politically. For instance, if we want to talk about the future of an equitable solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and a future for Palestine that is based on equality of rights and reciprocity of rights, and talk about a solution that does justice to the fundamental rights of both peoples, then you have to name the peoples in question, and the common designation is Israeli Jewish people and Palestinian Arab people. Well, Israeli Jewish people, I already identified the problem with Israeli Jewish people, coupling religion, a religious designation with a political designation. And if a mainstream Zionist would say, well, Judaism is also nationality, then you can't talk about a solution between the Israeli Jewish people and the Palestinian Arab people, because inside the state of Israel, 20% of the citizens are Palestinian Arabs. So they are citizens of the state; they are under the sovereignty of the state of Israel, but they are Palestinian Arab by national designation. And you have to respect their rights and their position in the equation in a way that does justice to their rights and to their identity. So, but if you use my suggested terminology, you would say that the future of Palestine should be a political system where the Palestinian Hebrew people and the Palestinian Arab people are resident on the basis of equality of rights, respecting the values of the 30 articles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the UN Charter, regardless of whether the country of Palestine is divided into two states, into three states, or integrated in a single unitary and democratic state, in whatever part of Palestine between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, the Palestinian Hebrew people and the Palestinian Arab people should reside on the basis of equality of rights to all, that the citizenship of the unitary state or the citizenship of the Palestinian state or the citizenship of the Israeli state should be a democratic citizenship accountable to democratic constitutions and democratic values. And it matters less if you are a citizen of the State of Israel. How shall I put it? You could be a Palestinian Hebrew citizen of the State of Israel, a Palestinian Arab citizen of the State of Israel, a Palestinian Hebrew citizen of the State of Palestine, a Palestinian Arab citizen of the State of Palestine. You could have single citizenship. You could have dual citizenship treaty between the two states. It could be a unitary state by equal measure, provided it respects fundamental values and democratic procedures. So there is some mileage with referring, at least legally, to the constituencies as Palestinian Hebrew people and Palestinian Arab people, Hebrew taking its primary semantic reference from the national language of the Hebrew people, and Arabic taking its primary semantic import from the Arabic language rather than Arabic ethnicity. It's helpful, and it could be productive. I also want to say that national identities are constituted identities and contested identities, and of course one has to argue one's patch and develop one's structures against alternative narratives, but that's the game worldwide, and that's the game in Palestine. And I believe the most attractive proposition is likely to prevail. So prior to 1948, prior to the ethnic cleansing of the country of Palestine from its indigenous population, the Palestinian Arab population, the country was governed by the British Mandate between the two world wars, and prior to the First World War by the Ottoman Empire. And the system under the Ottoman Empire was rather interesting because communities were given considerable autonomy under Ottoman law as millah, as confessions. And there was an equilibrium there which was creative and productive for all parties concerned, but it was an equilibrium governed by the Muslim Sharia law under a Muslim empire, the Ottoman Empire. Much of that was then introduced into the mandate legislation. And so long as the legal divisions were divorced from a settler colonial enterprise, relationships have been reported to be in the main amicable. The conflict simmered and then erupted as political Zionist settler colonial projects developed, and largely developed under the sponsorship and the auspices of the British Mandate. The best explanation for that symbiosis that I came across were the memoirs of the first governor, British Mandate governor of Jerusalem, Roland Storrs, who said in his memoirs that in his view, the large Zionist ambition of establishing a major Jewish state between the Mediterranean and the Jordan, or even beyond, was very much against British imperial interests, that it would serve the British Empire well to establish in Palestine a small Jewish Ulster. And that's what they did.
Given that we're currently in the holiday season, or the holiday season is approaching, can you tell us what the mood is like around Hanukkah celebrations for an anti-Zionist Palestinian Jew like yourself, or for other conscientious activists like the Refuseniks, some of whom are spending the holiday period in prison?
Well, this is a very individual and highly personal question, and I'll meet the challenge and I'll answer very much in individual capacity and in personal capacity. I've got 5 languages in my family: Hebrew, English, Finnish, Dutch, and Spanish. I've got 3 citizenships in my family: Israeli, UK, and 4 citizenships, and Finnish. I've got a wing in my family that has its origin in a Christian community. My family is largely secular, so holiday represent cultural highlights of celebration rather than religious highlights of celebration. And in the Jewish context, yes, one such highlight would be Hanukkah or Passover, when the family gathers around the celebratory table. In Christian context is, of course, the Christmas. So you are interviewing me while I'm in transit in the United Kingdom, en route to Helsinki to join my Finnish family for the family gathering over the Christmas table in Finland. So I have no problem in celebrating the various divisions and sections of the cultural heritage represented in my family. And the reason I have no problem, I believe, is because the family is largely secular. It embraces what is beautiful in its cultural baggage and rejects what is ugly and racist. I regret to say that I await a Muslim input into my family, extended family circles, and I have to wait for that until and if any one of my offsprings decides to fall in love with a person with Muslim heritage rather than Christian or Jewish heritage. So for me, multiculturalism is